Okay, so now we're going to start with the second part of the short course sessions this morning, and we're just going to get a little bit of an introduction to the basic model and some simple extensions to this basic model of viral dynamics that you'll probably be seeing a lot this week. Okay, so last week and, well, 2 weeks ago, so the first block of this thematic program focused more on the epidemiology of infectious disease modeling. And the third block will also be focusing more on epidemiological processes and modeling in epidemiology. But we're, as you saw this morning, going to be focusing on the immune system and virus dynamics. And so we're now going to learn about the basic model of virus dynamics in the immune system. Okay, so something that you didn't see this morning is a map of the immune system. So here you have a picture of the immune system. You have all the lymphatics right here. These little blue things are the lymph nodes where a lot of the cells of the immune system reside. You have the spleen, which is the main part of the immune system, the thymus as well, which is very important for the T cells that were talked about a lot. And the bone marrow is very important for those B cells and T cells as well. So you can see here that you have this large map of things that the immune system uses to protect you from diseases. Okay, but most of what you're going to see in mathematical modeling is not going to include the spatialness of the immune system. Okay, and that is a simplifying assumption, which we'll talk about later. So here you have a lymph node. Those are those little blue dots that you saw in the previous diagram. And the lymph node is actually also very spatial. And different parts of these lymph node, of the lymph node, tell you where B cells and T cells reside. Okay. So this is also very spatial, which you could incorporate in a mathematical model. But the basic model that we're going to talk about doesn't include this spatialness, and we'll talk about why we make that assumption. Okay, so this is how the immune system works. So you get infected in the peripheral tissue, your antigen-presenting cells migrate to the lymph node, activate your T cells and B cells, and these T cells and B cells can then migrate to the periphery, and they can do that by migrating up here, and then they get pumped back down to the periphery as well. Okay, something that's important to know about the lymphatic system is that we don't have a heart that's pumping it. Okay, so it actually, these cells migrate using just differences in pressure. So when you move, you're actually helping your immune system work. Okay, so people who are lethargic can get sick more often. So play sports. Okay, and so this is just what I said. You do not move, the lymph does not move well. Very sedentary individuals are frequently sicker than their thinner counterparts for this very reason. So you heard a lot about different cells of the immune system this morning, and you can see that, I mean, they're different, many different cells again. They can differentiate into many different other cells, and so this can make mathematical modeling where you incorporate the immune system very, very, so your models can get very, very large. But part of our job is to figure out what is the most important part of the immune system, or can we just, you know, include the immune system in certain parameter values in our models. We can also, as Bhargavi was talking about, incorporate the development of memory in our models by allowing our cells to go through the different stages of naive, adaptive, and memory cells, so that if we're, for example, looking at measles or influenza, where immunity is important, you can then have these memory cells lying around for different initial conditions of your model when you're when an individual is exposed again, so that you get this quick and much better secondary response, and you don't need to worry about the primary response anymore for that. And that, but then again, just as you saw on Bargavi's slide, that you can have this response to antigen B, which is still primary, but you get a secondary response to antigen A because you've accumulated some memory against antigen A. Okay. You can also include that in your mathematical models. You can also, so here you have a primary response, a secondary response, and years later, you can still have your immunological memory where you can get a mild or inapparent reinfection. So you could also get asymptomatic infections where you could be able to transmit still. And you can also incorporate that in mathematical modeling. Okay. And all of these types of models are going to be built upon this basic model of virus dynamics, which we'll look at during this short course. Okay, so as you saw this morning, the immune system is complicated and complex. You have many different cells and parts of the lymphatic system. You can mount different types and intensities of responses. The immune system learns from experience and exhibits memory. And obtaining an integrated view of the immune system will actually entail the development of models that look at the immune system in various ways. So you can have qualitative models and quantitative, where you're actually looking at quantities or just the qualities of their responses. So in virus dynamics, as you saw from Benny's presentation this morning as well, that pathogens are also complicated and complex. And the immune response to these pathogens is complicated and complex. You have many different pathogens. They can interact and infect different cells and parts of the lymphatic system. You can have chronic infections like HIV and some hepatitis C patients. Herpes is another chronic infection where you have these mild outbreaks. Or you can have acute infections that where you clear them, like measles or influenza. Okay. These chronic infections as well go through an acute stage of infection, but the difference between a chronic infection and an acute infection is that you don't clear it. And there are some pathogens, such as hepatitis C virus, where some people will experience an acute infection and clear it, and then other people will experience this acute infection and won't be able to clear it and then become chronically infected. And we don't really understand exactly why that's happening, and that's something that mathematical modeling can help out so that we can try to figure out why this is occurring. So you also, with virus dynamics, have different fitness landscapes of the strains, and that's very important in influenza, but not so important in measles. Okay. Also, you can link what you see in host to transmissibility of a pathogen between hosts. And you can look at the evolution of a pathogen in host and figure out how that affects the evolution of the pathogen in a population. Okay. So mathematical models can be used to study viral dynamics as well as the immune system and their interaction. So mathematical modeling, a view of some results, have improved our understanding of the immune system, its workings, and how it fights a pathogen. And a lot of this this basic work with this basic model is attributed to a lot of work by Dr. Perelson's group in Los Alamos. It has also given us results regarding evolution and the transmission of viral pathogens. But it's a relatively young field compared to mathematical epidemiology, for example. And part of that is because we've only now begun to have, only recently, to have the experimental techniques that are sensitive enough for us to be able to understand the immune system and virus dynamics in a host or even in a petri dish, so that we can actually gain information from experiments so that we can get data and parameter values for our mathematical models, that we can develop models that will help out with these experiments in the lab and clinical hypotheses for patients. So there have been great advances in mathematical modeling in HIV, hepatitis C virus, hepatitis B virus, LCMV, also in just understanding how T cells work and how they differentiate, how they proliferate, how they become memory cells. And also, this work has been very important so that in giving us information on how long these different cells of the immune system live, and how long infected cells of these different pathogens live, and how different cells of the immune system can go and kill these infected cells. We can get a lot of these parameter values from using simple mathematical models compared to some simple data acquired from the laboratory. Compare those two, and you can figure out certain death rates and other characteristics of the pathogen and the immune system. And Catherine Beauchemin, who is one of the organizers of this week, does a lot of this with the flu. And so you'll be hearing about some of that tomorrow morning. So mathematical modeling has mainly focused on chronic infections. And only recently have we actually started to look at acute infections. So a lot of this work is done on flu, and like I said, hepatitis B virus and hepatitis C virus can be acute infections or chronic infections. So people are looking at trying to figure out why some people only have an acute infection and why some people have a chronic one. And I have looked at measles. Try to model measles and figure out the how immune memory is accumulated and how immune memory responds to more exposures of measles in your lifetime. So one reason why acute infections weren't looked at previously, really, is because it's difficult to collect data about disease progression in acute infections. And this is mainly because symptoms are usually very late. In measles, for example, you don't show symptoms until about 14 days of infection. And by the time someone has shown symptoms, you might be able to, you know, try to figure out what their viral load is and their antibodies and their T cells, but you've missed about half of what's been happening already. Okay. Also, the disease is usually short-lived. With the flu, the disease can be as short as 3 days. So it's very hard to get information on something that only occurs in 3 days, where the symptoms might only start showing on the end of the first day of infection, for example. So it's hard to get data on this stuff. So it was also thought that immunologically based models would provide little extra insight above epidemiological models when researching acute infections. So we have this huge field of mathematical epidemiology, and the thought was that these acute infections, they're so short-lived that, but the infection in a population is much takes much longer to go through the whole population than it does for one infection of an individual in the population for these acute infections. So it was thought that we don't really need to know about what's happening in one person and just focus on what's happening between the people and assume some sort of transmission term which will account for what's happening in one person. Okay? But only recently, very recently, I keep on saying recently, but very recently, some studies of in-host models of acute infections have led to immunoepidemiological models where they incorporate the immune system in-host and how this links to transmission between hosts, describing disease progression so that we can look at how an individual's immune system might be able to affect, say, the evolution of influenza in a population. So this is the basic model of virus dynamics. And the, well, I was at a conference last week in Pittsburgh for the Society of Industrial and Applied Mathematics, and Alan Perelson was there, and he gave a big plenary on HIV modeling, and he says that virus dynamics, or this field, has been attributed to himself and Martin Novak for starting out this whole field of virus dynamics. And both of these groups of Perelson and Novak started out with a very simple model that looks like this. This is the basic model of virus dynamics. So, and we're going to look at this in more detail and extensions of this in this short course, but for now we'll just go through what each equation means very slowly, and if you have questions, you can ask. Okay, so you have in virus dynamics, as you saw from our presentations this morning, you usually have cells that are healthy, these cells get infected, and you have free virus. Okay. So these cells here are healthy cells, and this gives you how this healthy cell population changes over time. Okay. These healthy cells are assumed to be born at a constant rate. Okay. They die with a certain death rate, and the healthy cells, when they bump into virus, the virus will infect them, and then you can get infected cells. Okay. Infected cells are these Ys. They're produced by a virus infecting, I'm going to call it a virus because I'm going to focus really just on viral dynamics and not bacteria and other things. The virus bumps into a healthy cell, it infects it, and these infected cells die with a certain rate A. And we can generally assume that this rate A is greater than D. Okay? So infected cells live for a shorter length of time than healthy cells. And we can attribute this to the fact that a lot of pathogens will use up the energy and all the resources in a cell to making itself replicate and produce. Okay, so these cells, all these resources will be used up quickly, and so they can die from that. Or some pathogens actually aren't. That's called a lytic virus. Some pathogens aren't lytic. Okay, like hepatitis C virus is not. And when it infects a cell, this accelerated death rate actually is only due to the fact that the immune system is coming and killing these infected cells. So you can have that the virus is lytic, that the immune system is killing it, or you can have a combination of those two things, which you can incorporate into this death rate A. Okay. So these infected cells produce virus by budding them, or they can burst. Okay. So, and it's not really known for some virus pathogens whether you get a continuous budding of virus over the infected cell's lifetime, or whether all of these new virus particles kind of accumulate in the cell, and then the cell will burst and then releases them all. Okay. So this K can represent a continuous budding, or it can represent this bursting. Okay? And if it's bursting, this K will depend on A. Okay? And then our virus particles are cleared from the body by the immune system, so our antibodies. Okay, so that's the basic model of virus dynamics. So one disease that has been looked at a lot by this basic model is HIV. And so I'm going to give you how the different steps that you just saw in that basic model are represented in that basic model by looking at this virus life cycle. Okay. So here you have your HIV virion. and it has two strands of RNA. It also has protease, an enzyme called protease, and an enzyme called reverse transcriptase. Okay. So what happens is it binds to our healthy cell, which, by the way, in HIV is your CD4 T cell. Okay. So those T cells that Bhargavi was talking about that are the brains of the immune system that go out and activate the rest of the immune system, that is the main target for HIV. Okay, and that's why HIV is so bad. So your T cells can be depleted over time, which leaves these HIV patients open to other diseases. Okay. So your HIV virion fuses, and then it releases its RNA and viral proteins into the cell. Okay. Then what happens is your RNA is transcribed into DNA using the reverse transcriptase that it brought with itself. Okay. The RNA is then made into, the DNA is then made into a double strand, and it is incorporated into the DNA of the cell. So it's incorporated into the host genome, and then that makes the cell programmed to start making more HIV virus RNA and proteins. Okay, so it's going to make HIV virion. So here you can see that new proteins from the viral DNA are being synthesized, and here you have the enzymes that are coming out, and then also the receptors of the protein coat. And then what happens is that enzyme protease that it brought with itself is used to assemble the capsid and then break off from the cell, and then your virion is born and can go off and infect more CD4 T cells, or another CD4 T cell. Okay. So if you, in our HIV talks that you'll be hearing about this week, you may hear about reverse transcriptase inhibitors and protease inhibitors. And here, this is what a reverse transcriptase inhibitor inhibits. It stops this RNA from being transcribed into DNA. So with a reverse transcriptase inhibitor, your cell actually won't become an infected cell. Okay? If you have protease inhibitors, your cell can become an infected cell, but all of the virions that are budded from a cell that has a protease inhibitor in it will be not infectious. They will be non-infectious virions that we budded. So you have free virus that won't be able to infect other CD4 T cells. Okay. Now, Benny this morning talked about mutation rates of different viruses, and this is actually very, very error-prone here. Okay. And this can produce many, many different strains of HIV. So what we found with HIV in HIV models, that when, if you put in one reverse transcriptase inhibitor, these patients quickly get strains that are resistant to that reverse transcriptase inhibitor because this mutation rate is very, very high. Okay. Same with the protease inhibitors. The mutation rate up here is so, so high that if you only put in one protease inhibitor, you can get drug resistance quite quickly. Okay. So what we found in research in for HIV and in mathematical modeling of HIV is that what you need to do is you need to throw many, many drugs in a drug cocktail so that this these mutations. Okay, so you have to accumulate more mutations to get drug resistance to this drug cocktail, so you're less likely to get drug resistance when you when you're taking these drugs. Okay. So with HIV, these healthy cells that you saw, they're the CD4 T cells that are not infected. You have your infected CD4 CD4 T cells that have, so here I've just shown it where here you have your CD4 T cell and you have an HIV virion inside it. And here you have your free virus. Okay. So remember before I showed you that big map of the immune system and of the lymph nodes. And the T cells actually kind of live in these lymph nodes and then they move out into the periphery. Now, you'll probably notice that this model does not incorporate spatial effects at all. Okay? Instead, we're using homogeneous mixing. Okay? So we're assuming that our system is very well stirred. Okay? Now, for some pathogens, this is a very realistic assumption because if the pathogen gets into the blood, then it is very well stirred because your heart is pumping, pumping, pumping. Okay? And that actually is the case for HIV. The system is very well stirred, so this is not too bad of an assumption. Okay? This is also true for measles. Measles gets into the blood, so it's a well-stirred system. For flu, this is not the case. Okay? And so it might be important for models of influenza to start incorporating, and they do, the spatial effects of infection in the respiratory tract. So here we have infection, and there we have the budding of the virus. Okay, so this is the course of infection for HIV. And so here we have our healthy cells and our infected cells. And this is just the beginning of infection. So first, the HIV virus has to get through the innate immune system in order for it to get to the T cells, which are its main target. Okay, so up to this point, we can calculate some probability of infection. It has to get past the innate immune system. It can also just be cleared probabilistically. Maybe a virion infects a cell, and HIV virions can also infect parts of the innate immune system. So these cells maybe might die before they actually start producing virus. So it can actually be cleared in some people up to here. There is a clearance probability, but that depends on probably on how much how large the initial viral load is that came into this patient. And it would also depend on where the exposure was, whether it was a needle stick right into the blood or whether it was through sexual transmission. Okay. So once you get past that point, then your acute stage of infection will occur. Okay, and for some pathogens, this acute stage will actually go back down to zero. Okay, but with HIV, it doesn't. And then we start this latent stage of infection, which in a patient that's not on drug therapy can last for up to about 12 years. Okay, so after this latent stage, and you can see here during this stage that your viral load is approximately level over this latent stage. And your CD4 T cell count actually only has a very small decrease over this whole latent stage. Okay. But then, at a certain point, when your CD4 T cells reach a level less than 200 cells per microliter of plasma, that's when an HIV patient is diagnosed with AIDS. Okay. And then this is where your CD4 T cells, you're so immunocompromised, you're susceptible to all these other diseases, your CD4 T cells are also still being infected by HIV, and your CD4 T cells can decline and your viral load can blow up, and it will ultimately lead to death of the patient. Okay. Now, the basic model that I showed you only models certain parts of this diagram. Okay. So it can be used to look at acute infection and the latent period only. It does not model the stage, this stage at all. Okay? But it has been a very, very, very useful model to use, because what happens is during this latent stage, remember I said that the viral load and the CD4 T cells are approximately at an equilibrium. Okay? And when mathematicians hear equilibrium and they know they're using differential equations, the first thing they think is, ah, I can go and figure out my equilibria of my model. And then I can compare my equilibria to data of infected patients. Okay? And that's actually how the field of virus dynamics was started. They took this basic model, they had some data of a few days of infection of different patients during this latent stage. So they could actually, during this latent stage as well, make simplifying assumptions that your target cell population is approximately level, is approximately constant. So your healthy T cell population is no longer a variable, it's just a parameter. Okay, so your X, your little X becomes capital X for constant. Okay. And then they're just working with two equations, one for infected cells and one for viral load. Okay? Then when you put these patients in this latent stage on drug therapy, you can then measure the decline of the virus and the infected cells over time, and you can get information as to giving you how long the infected cells live and what the clearance rate of the virus is. Okay? You can... And this is done through labeling experiments. So they took these experiments, compared it to the model, and they were able to find different half-lives for the cells and the virus. Okay. They also used experiments, or these experiments in the lab and patient data, to determine what the budding rate of HIV is and what the mutation rate is. Okay. So even though this model is not perfect and doesn't include all of the different stages of infection, it can, this simple model can give us a lot of information about the immune system and the pathogen. Okay? And if you have had experience in mathematical epidemiology with the SIR equation, you've also seen that such a simple SIR model, that such a simple model as that can be used to describe many things, many different diseases in a population. And this simple virus dynamics model can be used to determine lots of things about the immune system and the pathogen in a person. Okay. So you can also use an extension of the simple model to look at acute infection. And if you're interested in learning a little bit more about measles, you can talk to me at the end, which I've done. I've done a model where I have an acute infection of measles, which actually clears. Then I also have the development of immune memory. And what we do is we look at how immunity will wane over time and how that will affect you when you're older if you're re-exposed to the measles pathogen, whether you just get whether you get a secondary response where nothing happens and then you might just get a boost in your immune system, or you can get a mild or inapparent reinfection where it could be an asymptomatic infection and you could transmit measles without knowing. Okay? So now that we've learned a little bit about why this model is good, let's actually do a little bit of work about, like, gain a little bit more knowledge about this model. So something that we can do is, like I said, we can determine the uninfected and infected equilibria, and we can also determine a very important parameter called the basic reproductive ratio, or basic reproduction number, which tells us whether infection will grow or whether it will die out. Okay, so now I'm going to move over to the overhead, and we're going to go over some simple extensions to this model. that's not it. So we have this simple model, which is dx. Okay. And we can find our uninfected and infected equilibria. And our uninfected equilibrium is given by lambda over d, 0, 0. And I'm not actually going to write down the infected equilibrium. You can find that on your own. Okay. But what's important about the uninfected equilibrium is that you can use that, you use that to determine what the basic reproductive ratio is. Okay? And it turns out that the basic reproductive ratio for this model, which we call R0, is given by beta x naught, which is our uninfected equilibrium, over U times K over A. Okay. So what does this number mean in terms of the biology? Okay. So what you need to do when you look at your basic reproductive ratio is you always should look at that and figure out how this is reflecting the biology of the system. Okay. Now in virus dynamics, what you have to do, so this is defined as the number of infected cells produced by one infected cell in a totally susceptible population, or it can be defined as the number of infectious virions produced by one infectious virion in a totally susceptible population. Okay, so what that means is if you start with a virion, the virion will then infect a cell, and that infected cell will bud virus, and only actually a certain fraction of those of that population of new budded virus is actually infectious. And so you would only count the infectious virions. So your R0 would go from one infectious virion to an infected cell to infectious virions. So you'd count that. Or you can say that your R0 can start with one infected cell. That infected cell then produces some infectious virions, and those infectious virions then go and infect cells. Okay, so it's a cycle that has to be closed, and you can think of it from starting at one point or the other. Okay, so here, if we look at this, remember beta is our infection rate, and we have our X0, so we can say that we started with one infectious virion. Our virion went and infected a healthy cell in its lifetime. So U was the clearance rate. So 1 over U is the lifetime of a virion, the average lifetime. Okay. So now we've made an infected cell, and that infected cell then buds virus with this rate K, which could be continuous budding, or it could actually be a burst. Okay. And A was the death rate of the infected cells, so 1 over A is the average lifetime of an infected cell. Okay. So we started with a virion, it infected a cell, then the infected cell produced more virus, and so we've actually closed the cycle. Or we can start with an infected cell. The infected cell buds virus in its lifetime, and all of those virus particles can then go and infect healthy cells in their lifetime. And we can assume that this X0 is still constant in that scenario, because we're assuming that there's so many target cells that they're not, that these infectious virions are not in competition with each other. Okay? Now, if our target cell population is very, very small, then we can't use this to give us what R0 is. And there are many different ways that you can calculate R0. And if you're interested in figuring out and learning about many different ways, then you can see a publication by myself, Robert Smith, and Dr. Wall, Lindy Wall, that gives a review of different methods that you can use to calculate R0 with different systems. Okay. But what's wrong with this model? Oh, also, I should just say that if R0 is greater than 1, then the infection will progress. If R0 is less than 1, it will die out. Okay. Now, does anybody see what's wrong with this model? You can just point out maybe one thing, and I'll maybe lead you towards it. Is I've been talking about how when a virion infects a cell, it goes inside the cell. Okay? And this model is not actually reflecting that this year. So there should actually be a minus beta XV term here to reflect that property of the biology. Okay? But the reason why that's not there is because it can be assumed that that term is very, very small compared to this clearance rate. Okay? So you can ignore it for a lot of things. And a reason why it's ignored in HIV models is because during that latent stage of infection, that term is very, very small. Okay? But I'll just throw out to you, and you can agree with me or not, that that term is actually important in the initial stages of infection. Okay? This beta times X can be quite big and can be of the similar magnitude to you. And so if you incorporate that term, this minus beta XV here, then your R0 will change. Okay, so your R0 changes to this, where now this is, you have one infectious virion, and this is the probability that it infects the cell in its total lifetime. So its total lifetime now is 1 divided by beta X0 plus U. Okay, so beta X0 over that is the probability that it infects the cell. And then this is the term where you have your infected cells budding virus. Okay? So there are also lots of other simplifying assumptions that have been made in the basic model. Another thing that I said that might have got you thinking about this basic model and how it reflects the biology is that a lot of the virions that are budded from cells are not actually infectious. So you can decide to keep track of the infectious virus population and the non-infectious virus population. Okay. The problem with that is that it's hard to tell what virions are infectious and which ones aren't. So when you're comparing your model to viral load, you would compare both of your populations summed together to the viral load population. Okay? But with HIV, it is assumed that only about 5% of the virions that are budded from an infected cell, and that number that's budded can be like between 500 and 5,000. Virion from an infected cell in its lifetime. Only about 5%, it's assumed, are infectious. And so you can see that when you throw in drug therapy and you decrease the virus, and you can also, which also affects the infected cell population, that your infectious virus population can actually get very, very small. And if you're thinking about this in terms of probabilities and stochasticity, then your infectious virus population could get so small that maybe it might be able to die out. But in HIV, this hasn't occurred, but if you're keeping track of your infectious virus population and your non-infectious virus population, then you can see how small this infectious virus population is actually getting, and it can lead you to some ideas of how maybe drug therapy is not working. Okay, and so to incorporate something like that, you might call your infectious virus population V, where you have KQ, Y minus UV, and then your non-infectious virus population is K1 minus Q, Y minus UV, where Q is the probability of a newly budded virion being infectious. So there are also some problems with this model in looking just at the budding. Okay, so if you're going to have a continuous bud rate of the virus, first you have to account for the time that it takes from a virion first infecting a cell to the cell actually being able to start budding virus. There are lots of things that need to happen before that can actually occur. And this was pointed out by Benny in his presentation this morning, where he had two types of infected cells, I1 and I2. And I1 were the cells that weren't producing virus, and I2 were the cells that were. Okay? And so you can incorporate that by changing the simple system of ODEs into a simple system of PDEs, where you count for the age of the infected cell. Or you can, instead of doing that, you can add one more ODE to your model where you have these I1s and I2s and have it so that your I1s progress to I2 over a certain period of time, so that these I2s are only the ones that can produce cells. Okay? So, if you want to look at the PDE, you can think about it in terms of this. So here we have our infected cells depend on their age, okay, and we have our dV by dt is given by our production from all of our infected cells, which depends on age, okay, and then our initial condition for our condition at zero age at time t is given by beta xv. Okay, so that's a PDE model that could look at this ramp up virus production, where PA gives you that equation that you can use for ramping up depending on the age of the infected cell. Okay. So something else, so that's one extension. And you can calculate your R0 for that. Another extension would be to say that maybe your healthy cells aren't produced at a constant rate. So maybe that lambda isn't constant. Maybe it should depend on different components of your body. Okay, and actually, there are T cell receptor excision circles, or TRECs, that you can measure in a person's body that can tell you whether a T cell actually came from the thymus, was born from the thymus, or whether that T cell was just made by a cell division. Okay. And if you can count these tracks in the body, then you can get some rate at which these new T cells are born. Okay? And what people have found is that these T cells, these tracks, actually, the rate of T cell production can increase until about puberty or a certain age, and Benny can correct me if I'm wrong. And then it can start, and then it will start declining gradually over your age. Okay, so you might want to change your healthy cell population to reflect that that lambda depends on the age of the person. Okay, and you might also want to include the fact that these cells can divide. So you can have where your body still can only sustain or can only have so many of these cells in a certain volume of blood. So you can use, you can have your T cells divide, but this comes to a carrying capacity or a T max that it shouldn't really go past that in crazy amounts. Okay, and that growth should also depend on your infected cells, because your infected cells are still part of that population. Yeah, so your infected T cells can divide as well. But when that occurs, so it's assumed in some models that your infected T cells can only divide when they're activated. Okay, that's when they proliferate. And your infected T cells can only be recognized by the immune system, for the immune system to go and kill them when they're activated. Okay, so you may also want to include the fact that there are many viral strains in your model, and so you can have, you can change it so that your Y populations and your I populations are strain, are indexed by strain. You can have, and this would be important for HIV and would also be important to keep track of strains maybe for influenza. So you have your healthy cells again, they're born and they die, and then you can have different viral strains indexed by I, and different strains can have different fitness, so may have different rates of infection. And then that infection process will make, infected cells of that strain, except for that you might have another mutation while that's occurring, where PIJ is your rate of mutation from strain J to strain I. Okay, and then you have your DVI by DT. And I just put the Q there to remind you of maybe there's a certain probability of having infectious virus. And then you can have your non-infectious virus, where it's just 1 minus Q. Okay. So it may be important for you to look at the different strains. And this would be important, for example, when you're looking at drug resistance. An evolution of drug resistance, where some strains are resistant to the drug and some aren't, and how during infection your wild type strain or your drug sensitive strain could produce drug resistant strains. Okay, so another thing that you can incorporate is drug therapy, where you can incorporate some efficacy terms. Where here, for example, if you're looking at HIV, this epsilon 1 would be the efficacy of the reverse transcriptase drug, because that prevents infection. And then if you want to look at the protease inhibitor, you can have this epsilon 2. Where your infectious virus is budded at a reduced probability, and your non-infectious virus is augmented by that efficacy. Okay, but this assumes a constant efficacy of your drugs, but your drugs are actually given in doses. So you can think of this as some sort of gradual increase in concentration and then decay, and then increase in concentration and decay like this. Okay, and if you incorporate this type of dosing in your model, then this is called a pharmacokinetic model. That's a C. Okay, and this is has been looked at in HIV modeling. You can also assume that this period of time to peak, so delta T1 and delta T2, you can see that if delta T1 is very small compared to delta T2, then you don't really need to worry about this increase as much. And so you can change your model to look at impulses. So this is an impulsive, you can use impulsive differential equations. Where you give defined times when these impulses occur, and then you use your model with your drug therapy to look at the times of the drug decay. Okay, and it's important to know that the drug will decay in the plasma, but the drug can also decay inside the cell. So, and these are at two different decay rates, but one probably depends on the other, and it's not really known how fast drug decays in the cell. Okay? And then the last example is we talked about these CD8 T cells. And so what you can do with the CD8 T cells is your infected cell population can actually have a term where you have cell death depending on these CD8 T cells, which can be given by Z. Okay, and your dZ by dt have actually been modeled in many different ways, and I'll just point out three of them for you today. C minus dZ, where C is the birth rate and dZ is the death rate. Or you can have dy minus dz, saying that the birth of these cells depends actually on the amount of infection that's around, okay? Which, remember you learned that there are naive, activated, and memory cells, and so this could say that you have some naive zeds around, but the activation of these would depend on the amount of infection or the number of antigen-presenting cells that are there, and the antigen-presenting cells can be proportional to your infected cells, or you can assume that it's proportional to the virus. Okay? Or you can change it a little bit further to say that this activation process actually is helped by the T cells, your helper cells, and so you may need them to be there as well. As your antigen-presenting cells for your activation, and then you have your death. Okay, So I've shown you some simple extensions of this basic model that reflects different parts of biology. But one comment at the end is that these models are all, except for the one that I did show you, these are ordinary differential equations, which means that they're assuming that the lifetime of the cells and the virus particles are exponentially distributed. So it's a Markov process, which means that the death of your infected cell or your healthy cell, whatever, does not depend on how old it is or anything that's happened in its past. Okay? So you may, if you know from an experiment or from talking to somebody else that maybe these cells actually have a different distribution that describes their lifetime, then you can move over to some partial differential equations. Okay? So you can extend this model to a PDE and see how that lifetime affects your basic reproductive ratio, how drug therapy is working, how it affects your infected equilibrium, for example. So there are many different things that you can do by just moving over to your PDEs. Then you can also look at spatial effects, for example, with the flu, the spatial effects of your respiratory tract might be important, because remember, this assumes homogeneous mixing, which is okay for some pathogens that get into the blood. Okay, but this simple model that I did show you, even though there are all these little problems with it, it has actually advanced this field by a great, great degree. And even though it's so simple, like you've seen with the SIR model, simple models can be very powerful. And I'm just going to end with that. If you have any questions, you can ask. And hopefully you'll see models like this week, and so you can see that what I've done today might actually be helpful for you.